In the anonymity that the darkness of night grants us, Gaer, Jeong-woo, and Soo-min stepped out of the subway into the streetlight's glow, only to vanish into the shadows, leaving no traces of their lives behind. Like ghosts swallowed by the night, their sudden disappearances sent chills throughout the community. Were their disappearances a coincidence, or was something more sinister lurking near Gaeyang Station? Some believed that this was merely a symptom of Korea's growing suicide rates. Their families refused to accept that this could be true. Until their loved ones were found, they'd keep hope that they'd return safe and sound. But rumors began to spread that the cold Han River winds carried the whispers of the dead. Welcome to Korean True Crime with me, your host, Mimi Mizuko. Thank you to Vix Mac, Lala, William White, G1 Edwards, Nico, Elijah Hancock, Anomanom, Dr. Bob, My96, Lumos, Emma Brown, David Tafoya, Adriana, Pip, Dade512, and Lisa for your support on Patreon. Thank you for voting on today's episode topic. Patrons vote on future episode topics and hear the episodes first and ad-free with early access. We now have a sticker bonus tier and a hoodie bonus tier. Become a patron for 3 months and earn a reward. Thank you to my amazing patrons for making this show possible. Warning, today's episode contains a considerable amount of discussion regarding suicide, self-harm, and the forms that these may be done. Listener discretion is advised. Korean True Crime has a new intro song produced by Jeffron Addy. Take a listen. On June 27, 2022, 24-year-old Kim Gaer left work at a company located in Gangnam, Seoul. She shared her trip to the salon by posting a selfie on Instagram, wearing a white mask and a short bob at 9 p.m. that night. Her hair was already short, which meant maintenance haircuts were a common occurrence. She captioned her post by writing, 130,000 won evaporates as soon as I get my perm hit by the rain and wind. If you've ever had a perm, you know that too high of humidity, let alone rain and wind, can completely ruin your perm. It ruins the process and you'll have to redo your hair all over again. Gaul was having a horrible day and lamented about it again on Instagram by writing, Gangnam is, after all, a place where you open your eyes and get your nose cut, which is a Korean phrase that means that you'll always suffer and there's nothing you can do about it. She was having a day where she felt like the world was against her. Gao decided to change her plans for the evening. And instead of going to the subway and heading home towards Gachi Mountain, she hailed a taxi and was never seen again. Gao didn't tell anyone where she decided to go at 9:30 p.m. that night. When Gaer didn't return home, her family began to worry. They tried calling and texting her to no success. Gaer was nowhere to be found and nobody could get in contact with her. It was unusual for her to disappear like this, so her family feared the worst. Kim Gaer's online presence was minimal. She occasionally posted on her two Instagrams, one public and one private. She posted photos with her sister and grandmother in front of restaurants and with high school friends. Her last post on her public Instagram was with her favorite beer, Goose Island. She posted her ruined perm for her family to see on her private account and then went silent. As Gaer's family sat at home, suddenly an ambulance arrived at 11 p.m. The emergency worker came into their home and stated that a 119 call was made, stating that a woman on the premises looked as if she was about to faint and needed medical assistance. The family was surprised, because none of them had made the call, and they had no idea why an ambulance would be there. They thought maybe the call was for a neighbor and the address was given wrong. But when they asked who made the call, it was Gaer. Why would Gaer contact the emergency line and request an ambulance for her sister when she was nowhere near home? The paramedics made sure that Gao's sister, Jimin, a pseudonym, was healthy before they left, and they reported that the person who made the false report was indeed out of contact for the past 2 hours. The family immediately believed that this was a call for help. Gao must be in danger and was calling to get someone to notice. But when the family then contacted the police to report Gao missing at 11:30 p.m., they discover that missing adult cases are not taken very seriously. In instances of missing adults, the Korean police post a picture of the missing person on a website that alerts everyone in the area by text. If they have CCTV footage of where the person went missing from, they'll also post that along with a description of what they were wearing, their age, height, and weight. The typical missing person's information is included. The police do this in lieu of patrolling for the missing adult, because it does take a lot of time to patrol for a missing adult who may have merely run away voluntarily or just gone off without telling anyone. The possibilities of where the missing adult could be are endless, and adults can make their own decisions, including running away. This is in cases that there is no reason to suspect violence or harm to the person. In instances of missing elderly, alerts and photos are sent regularly to anyone in the area, and the police do patrol. The police told the family that there's no reason to suspect that Gao was in danger, and that this was most likely a voluntary communication cutoff or runaway, because they said that if Gao was in danger, it was more likely that she would try to communicate with 119 to come to her, or pretend to be speaking to someone else when talking to the emergency services. For example, if she pretended to be calling to order food, or spoke to the emergency dispatcher in code as if she was talking to someone else. The police came to take their missing persons report from the family, but the situation was so confusing. Gao's sister told the police that she had lost contact with her sister around 9:30 p.m., which was when she should have been leaving the hair salon. Jimin showed the police the Instagram photo and her final texts, which both seemed unlike someone saying goodbye or someone in danger. The police had to make the decision to tell the family that Gao had likely run away from home willingly, but they would investigate the area she was last seen at. They needed to prepare the family in the case that Gao had voluntarily run away and didn't want to come home. It was also possible that Gao had a secret life they didn't know anything about, and she did run away. But the family wasn't willing to give up searching for her. Tracking Gao didn't prove to be difficult because the police officers visited the Gangnam hair salon and asked about her visit. The stylist reported it was a normal visit and that Gao had left a little bit before 9:30 p.m. At that time, the weather was terrible outside with wind and rain, which is worrisome since Gao had just gotten a perm. When she left the salon, she was seen getting onto the building's elevator, going down wearing a white button-up shirt, black pants, and gray rain boots, carrying a white purse. After she left the building, she hailed a taxi going towards Gayang Station, where the CCTV lost sight of her movements. There were no more leads on Gao's disappearance, but her family and the officers continued to put up posters and send alerts looking for her. The sister made a mistake by posting online to her family with the phone number, asking people to contact her if they knew anything about Gao's disappearance. But when the case was featured on the news, people began to search for her and her family's pages, which is pretty typical in any criminal case. People try to insert themselves into cases that are big, hoping to be an online sleuth who solved the case. But with the phone number posted online, anyone could now contact Gao's sister Jimin, and many, many people did. The type of people contacting Jimin were not helpful. 9 days after Gao went missing, on July 6th, the police discovered her blog, titled in English, Candid Space. What they saw would churn the sister's stomach, leaving her feeling sick and hopeless. In sorts, Gao did have another life that they didn't know about. They didn't know about the suffering she experienced in her private life and the strength she had to endure. The blog had 19 posts. The final post was titled, The Bare Face of My Depression and Loneliness, to those who face their own depression with me. Although the title sounds bleak, the content of the post was hopeful. Gao had created a blog as a way to document her journey with depression. She wrote, Hello, this is Kim Gao. I'm working on the project, My Real Face of Depression and Loneliness. She wrote that this project will be an extension of the last one she had done, which was titled Exploring Depression Boldly and Honestly. She wanted to write about her depression as a way of self-healing and being honest with herself about her life. It was also a school project. She said that she gained a lot of comfort from the comments that she received on her previous piece, and that it told her she wasn't alone in her experience with depression. She was still a college student, so her project was a part of her program. But she wanted to extend it beyond the classroom so that she could continue her therapeutic journey and help others. She put a date on the finished project, stating that it would be finished in December. Her last entry was posted on March 14th, months before her disappearance. She finished her last entry by writing that she still wasn't well yet. She still suffered from a lot of negativity about the help she received from those around her, and she knew that this perspective was not a true one. It was her depression speaking. She wrote, "I want to emphasize that these feelings and memories are from seeing the world crookedly. I sincerely ask you to truly accept those memories and don't throw away this precious opportunity to get help." In her previous post, she'd mentioned why she started the project, which was after she took a class about culture and arts, which was led by a teacher named Im Jae-chun. She wrote that school wasn't going well for her because of the COVID pandemic, closing many of the art exhibitions she was supposed to take part of. She felt her future was closing off. After joining Professor Im's class, she heard the professor speak about her own life experience, to which inspired her art. The professor's story was so profoundly inspiring to Gaul that she said she in that moment had enough courage to go to a hospital and immediately seek help for her suicidal thoughts. She revealed that that very morning, she had contemplated suicide and had prepared to die, but that class that day saved her life. This post was made in February 2021, just a month prior to her previous post. The comments on this post are a haven for women of all ages screaming into the void, hoping to relieve some of their own suffering in the face of their own depression. Many of the commenters return to this page multiple times to leave loving comments of support for those who are struggling, just as she was. Gaul's project, although still unfinished, has touched the hearts of so many who were too, just as she was with her professor, inspired to continue living. The remaining 17 posts on her blog are a collection of diary entries that she had made, beginning on November 4th, 2020, stating her intent to begin the project, and that she had entered into psychiatric care and was beginning to feel a bit better, but that she had a dark history with self-harm and suicidal thoughts. She wrote hopeful things that working through her own depression and being honest about it may help herself and others. Her second post detailed her decision to enter psychiatric care. Gaul wrote that she had difficulty waking up on time for class and appointments. She would often force herself to wake up hours before these events because the anxiety of going to a scheduled errand or appointment would make her worry all day. She tried to remind herself that many people see psychiatrists and that it wasn't just her problem. She wrote that she hoped depression wouldn't be the default of her life and that she didn't need to live forever as she was now, a sentiment I think too many people can relate to. Her post spiraled as her mind darkened, and she began to wonder how she might have ended her own life. Ultimately, she wrote that to minimize the suffering of her family, if she was to die, she would want to jump from a bridge into cold water. But in a moment of clarity, she wrote, "It will change, that this wouldn't be forever. She could change her future." She went to see a psychiatrist but struggled to talk about her past because she had experienced depression amnesia. Her thoughts turned to her grandparents. She was extremely close to her grandparents and has many photographs on Instagram of her and her grandmother. But she wrote that she wondered about her grandfather and his own struggle with depression. Gaul's memory of her grandfather smoking a cigarette, asking about her day, and holding her hand on the walk home from school as he listened intently to her talk about her friends was such a warm memory to her that she refused to let go of. She recalled that he always told the same stories, repeating them constantly, which annoyed her then, but now as an adult, she wished to hear them just one more time. When he passed away, she just wanted to see a smile telling her to stop crying and to feel his arms hug her once again. Although she knew her grandma and sister loved her very much, she felt that they were annoyed by her depression. unlike her grandpa, who always made time for her crying and scolded her lovingly. She felt that the only place she could comfortably cry was with her grandfather, and now she had nothing left. Which wasn't true, but her depression twisting her reality. Gaol told her life story through her next posts. She was raised by her grandparents and her father, who worked while her grandparents took care of her. But when she was 19, her grandfather passed away. She felt like she was the only one affected by his passing. Although, as many know, mourning is a very individual process and looks very different for everyone. Although her grandmother didn't mourn loudly, which made Gaul feel uncomfortable with how sorrowful she herself was feeling. She was one who sobbed loudly when sad, and her grandmother and sister were not. Gaul talked about her decision to enter into her career choice, which she states that she wonders if she truly even enjoys her career or if she chose it just to make other people happy. When people asked her about why she chose her career, she always answers, "Because other people praised me when I did X, Y, and Z." She never considered her own happiness. Was she determining her own value by how much help or happiness she could give to others? She worried that this was the truth. Gaul described her search for acceptance and love from others as a warm spotlight on stage. She wanted so badly to find herself in the spotlight, showered with love and attention, just as her grandfather had done for her. But she knew that the search for others, like her grandfather, might be a losing battle. After visiting her psychiatrist, she began receiving treatment for her sleep disorders. She experienced insomnia, panic attacks, night terrors, sleep paralysis, and sleepwalking. Because of her lack of sleep, she also experienced migraines that would make her easily stressed and quick to anger. But it would take time to treat these conditions. In the meantime, she wanted to talk more about her choices in life. She had gone to school for a degree in journalism, but after her grades began to fall, she switched to culture and arts because she felt more a passion for these classes. Her father disagreed with her change in degree, which caused a lot of friction in their relationship, but it may have been one of the only times Gaul was able to fully control a choice in her life, which meant this was a pivotal moment for her family to support her when she needed it most. But they didn't. They expressed disappointment in her for going to a different career that was deemed as less important and meaningful. Because her grades had dropped in the journalism classes, she lost her merit scholarship that was mostly paying for her schooling, alongside her father who promised to pay for her living expenses if she kept going to school. But whenever she did something that he didn't like, he would threaten to stop paying, which essentially made her feel like a hostage in her own life. She resented her family for treating her like she was an investment rather than a part of the family, because she wasn't profitable or bringing status to the family, which is a story that's shared by many East Asian children. A theme you can find in spoken word, poems, movies, books, and songs. Although not unique to Korea, it is shared experience by many in countries with very high education standards. Gaul detailed that she began to self-harm at this time. She woke in the middle of the night following an episode of sleep paralysis to see a laptop cable next to her bed. She couldn't recall placing the laptop cable there, but felt the need to wrap it around her neck and attempt to strangle herself. Although she said that she didn't have enough strength to end her own life, it was her strength to go on living that may have saved her. The psychiatrist then decided to prescribe her sleeping medication to stop the insomnia. The next day, she wrote that she hated hearing the word "jeonbo" from her peers. I'd never heard this slang term before, so I did some research and spoke to a few Korean peers of mine. "Jeonbo" is a term that stands for fucking burrow, which came from the popular Korean game StarCraft, which meant to burrow quickly. When burrowing, it essentially was a term calling their team to hang in there or hold on. "Jeonbo boteugi," which meant fucking hang on. The term isn't popular any longer, but was used as a meme for a while after it began to be used more mainstream. It made a resurgence for buying stocks when people would hold on to stocks to keep hanging in there. But it quickly fell out of popularity again. Now a term that some may use to merely mean endure until the day you're resurrected. It was used by some in video gaming once more, but also in campaigns for those who experience suicidal thoughts. They wanted to express to those who were suffering in silence to hold on for dear life, and no matter what happens, no matter how difficult life is, just hold on. Which, Tagao felt ignorant and like reckless advice. She wondered what they thought depressed people were already doing by merely existing. Kao decided to visit the Suicide Prevention Center on November 10, 2020, and they said she needed an emergency contact. After listing her sister's number down, she regretted it immediately. Her sister didn't know that she had depression or suicidal thoughts. How could she explain this situation to her sister? After leaving the center, she felt she made the trip for no reason because talking to the therapist wasn't helping. Then, on November 18th, 2020, she made her second trip to the psychiatrist. This time, they stressed the importance of her continuing her medication and prescribed her tranquilizers and medication for sleeping, depression, and migraines. She also experienced anemia, and they gave her supplements to help her with the dizziness that she started to have. Kyle decided she would start to do more things that made her happy, like visiting cafes and drinking warm tea in the sunlight. She had moments of relief from the sorrows in her mind, which gave her hope and brought her joy. Her worries turned to her sister finding out about her depression because on weekends, she often visited her sister and grandmother, but she had to take many different medications which her family would clearly see. She didn't want to face criticism or judgment from her family, although this may have been the paranoia she experienced from her depression speaking. By her third visit to the psychiatrist, she began to feel less nervous about going to her appointments. By this time, only her insomnia was improving. The rest of her symptoms were merely continuing at the same intensity, without worsening, which was progress to her. She knew she could endure at this rate. She said that if her medicine was a respirator, then counseling therapy was teaching her how to breathe deeply and healthily. What a nice sentiment. But she didn't have any intention of going to counseling further. She felt the medicine was all she could handle at this point. By November 25th, 2020, her medications began to work effectively. Her migraines stopped and she was sleeping through the night. Her urges to self-harm began to subside, but she was still experiencing stress and was overwhelmed by loud sounds. Only three people in her life knew she had dealt with insomnia and depression, which were three friends of hers. She'd been a bit more honest with them, but they grew so worried about her that she felt like a burden, which made her feel grateful in the end because of how much they did care for her. She doesn't name these friends, but I'm sure they know who they are, and I hope they read the thank you that she put into words for them. She stated that they made her feel like she is doing a good job being alive. By November 30th, 2020, Gail started to feel more confused consistently. She lost her wallet and phone by setting them down in public. She started to leave things on around the house, like electric blankets. She was scolded often by her father and grandma. Then she lost her brand new headphones. At her job, she started to make small mistakes that she had to constantly cover up or fix to avoid her manager scolding her too. The headaches and migraines returned, but only for a short while when she was stressed. In the end, she was thankful that she was finally sleeping through the night due to the medications. But then, on the 28th, the previous Saturday, she decided to try not taking her medications because of how tired and dizzy she felt when taking them. When the dizziness episodes came, the world felt like she was living through VR. No matter where she looked, she saw geometric patterns, even when she closed her eyes. The world felt just lightly unreal, as if she was experiencing a glitch in the matrix. Her sensitivity to sound began to increase. Buses, cars, people talking, any consistently loud noises enraged her and made her feel like she was going crazy. She wanted to endure, so she tried meditation and conscious breathing methods. That was her final diary entry that she posted as a part of her ongoing project, until her update in March of 2021, stating that she would be studying her mental illness as a part of the Boldly and Honestly Looking at Depression project. Without any more entries, it's impossible to know what Gao was thinking between her hopeful last post, thinking she would tackle her depression head-on and conquer it, to disappearing near the Gaoyang Bridge 471 days later. Gao walked across the Gaoyang Bridge at 11.02 p.m. on June 27th, the day she disappeared. A passing bus caught her in their camera as she approached the center of the bridge. This coincided with the time the 119 call was received from Gao stating that her sister might faint. That was the last anyone saw Gao. She might have made the extreme choice to take her own life by the method she said was the way she'd always planned to die. But the search for Gao won't end. Gao's body was never found, which her family holds out hope that this means she may have gone to the bridge to consider taking her own life, but instead ran away to start a new one. Perhaps it was the struggles of her life that she needed to get away from. Wherever she is, and whatever happened to her, I hope that she now is at peace. 10 days after she went missing, a detective found a note written on her laptop that they believed could be a note detailing her intent to commit suicide. The note's content was not released in its entirety, but in the letter she wrote, "I don't want anyone to be sad about my death," a similar line to what she expressed in her diary entries. The police continued to investigate the black boxes of cars and buses that crossed the bridge that day. When the first bus passed, it was 11:02, the time that Gao made the phone call. 8 minutes later, another bus crossed the bridge and had no sight of her the entire trip across. From the halfway point of the bridge where she was seen, reaching land in either direction would take less than 10 minutes. But that's not what the police suspected that she did. Although we cannot know for sure what happened to Gao, because even with divers, drones, and searches, nothing has been discovered. Gao's sister, Zimin, was forced to change her phone number following the public getting access to it. She began to receive prank calls and texts, some with malicious intent. She received one text message that said, "Why are you searching for her? If she's going to kill herself, she should just do it. Don't waste our tax money." Others sent her sexually explicit photos and texts. While mourning her sister, she was tormented by these messages. Despite the signs pointing to her sister's unfortunate suicide, the investigation has continued to this day in 2024, with all possibilities open. A few weeks passed, and the police received a call that sounded like deja vu. A call came in that another person had gone missing after leaving Haiyang Station 6 weeks later on August 7, 2022. The missing man was Yi Jiangwu, a 25-year-old man who had just finished a night out with his friends. He'd gone out for dinner and drinks earlier that night with a group of friends and enjoyed the evening, or so it appeared to his friends. The group stayed out until the late hours of the night, until near 1:30 a.m. on the morning of the 7th. After saying goodbye to his friends, he got on the subway at Airport Market Station on the Seoul Subway 9. He rode the subway only 4 stops, which approximately takes 10 minutes to travel. But from 1:30 to 2:15 a.m., there's no sight of Jiangwu. Despite the trip only needing to take the 10 minutes, Jiangwu doesn't exit the station at Kaiyang until 2:15 a.m., 45 minutes later. He is caught on the exit 4 CCTV and appeared to be under no duress. He just walked calmly to his destination without any unusual behavior. He clutched his phone in his hand instead of placing it in his pocket, but he didn't use it while he waited for the train. But when he left Gaoyang Station, he moved out of the camera's view and wouldn't be seen again. However, as he left, he decided to make a phone call. He called his girlfriend and told her about his night. He gave generally vague answers about his evening and didn't say anything out of the ordinary. They spoke for about 15 minutes without him saying anything that stood out. After he said goodnight to his girlfriend and ended the call, he turned off his phone. It was possible his phone had also died. However, it was within a minute of ending the call. He hadn't told his girlfriend that his phone was dying and he needed to get off the phone, so it was more likely that he had turned off his phone himself. After he turned off the phone, while walking towards Kaiyang Bridge, he disappeared into thin air. Because he was out so much later than Gao was, there were no buses servicing the area. There were even very few drivers on the road, and not many people out walking. So when he approached the bridge, there weren't any people to see what happened next. When his family reported him missing the next day, the police's hands were tied. Unlike Gao, who had a history of depression and had called the ambulance, which qualified as odd behavior, Jiangwu didn't have any reason to be considered a missing person. Under the law, a person is considered missing when they're under the age of 18, are intellectually disabled, or have a mental impairment like dementia or Alzheimer's that could lead to them being confused. Because of this, the police had to mark Jiangwu as a runaway, meaning that he cut off contact with his family voluntarily. This also meant that he abandoned his home and belongings, which the police would need to wait longer than 24 hours to classify. In order for the police to track down a missing adult who doesn't qualify under the previous impairments, they would need to have a witness who saw a crime committed involving the missing person as the victim or perpetrator, or have a reason to believe that the missing person is a danger to themselves or others. An example of this would be like Gal's text history to her friends discussing her depression, or her blog detailing her suicidal thoughts. When the police have things like these, they can go ahead and obtain a warrant to track the person and find them. But in Jung Woo's case, there was no legal basis to track him in any capacity. In this situation, the law was clear. Jung Woo was not a missing person yet. He would be classified as a runaway, but until more time had passed and the family could prove he was indeed missing or was in danger, there was no basis for the police to invade his rights. For example, tracking his phone's location, checking his call history, or tracking him via CCTV. If he was indeed someone who had voluntarily just gone silent to the world for a weekend, then the police would be wasting resources and invading someone's privacy. Sometimes the laws are just, but the situation is unique. In the passing days, Jung-woo's family continued to search for him, trying to find him on their own. His own brother decided to reach out online for help finding the location of Jung-woo. In many missing persons cases, utilizing the far reach of social media can quickly help find someone. Jung-woo's family was very aware of Gal's missing person case because this case was being so heavily compared to it. Although they didn't have many similarities beyond their location, people were trying to say that something paranormal lured them to the bridge, or that there was some criminal organization that was kidnapping people in the late hours of the night. When Jung-woo's brother, pseudonym Sunil, posted his missing persons information on the popular forum website Bobe Dream on August 10, 2022, 3 days after Jung-woo went missing, he did include his phone number just as Gal's sister did. However, Sunil put a disclaimer asking people not to send in fake information or make prank calls. Although that was inevitable when putting your phone number online, but I'm willing to bet he got less sexually explicit texts. In the following days, there was no information that came from the missing person's post. His phone was still turned off, and they couldn't find anything in the area of Gayang. A week later, on August 14th, Sunil returned to the online forum to address the rumors that his brother had merely run away from home. The situation with his brother being registered as a runaway instead of a missing person was misunderstood by the public, who now thought the family was trying to track down Jung-woo, who had merely cut off contact with them. Sunil was upset at the accusations because they were still trying to find his brother desperately without the full efforts of the police, because they didn't have any evidence he was in danger. He wrote, "It's been a week since we started looking for Jung-woo. How much more time must pass before he is missing? A man in his 20s can go missing." He lamented about the law preventing his brother from being considered a missing person. There's no definite amount of time that would qualify Jung-woo from being considered a missing person, but eventually, he'd be tardy for taxes, health insurance, and car payments, and other companies would start looking for him. But the police couldn't due to the law, and they couldn't use their full resources to search for him until they had something concrete like Gal's suicide blog and suicide note. He continued, "How much more heartbreak must we endure before his disappearance can be investigated? Please help us. We're looking for traces of Jung-woo." Just over a month later, Jung-woo's cousin appeared on television to talk about updates in the case. They didn't have any leads about what happened to Jung-woo or what might have happened to drive him away. Nobody wanted to discuss the possibility that he had committed suicide on the bridge. Unlike Gal, who had a record of mental illness and depression, nobody had any idea of difficulties that Jung-woo might have been facing. There really wasn't anything for them to go off of for where to look for him. He hadn't written anything concerning or said anything out of the ordinary to any friends or family, at least that was shared. But then, on September 24th, 2022, when Jung-woo's cousin went on television to talk about the case, he revealed the discovery had indeed been made. Near Gwangsangbo on Gwanghwa Island, in the mudflats, the lower half of a body was found. The police didn't know whose body this was because of the advanced decomposition from it being in the water during the summer and then washing up onto the mudflats. Animals had had access to the remains for however long it was there. The remains indicated that they were Jung-woo's because of the pants and shoes that were found. The remains that were found only included the hips and legs. The torso, head, arms of the deceased were nowhere to be found. Due to the advanced decomposition of the body, they couldn't determine the cause of death, although Jung-woo's body was not the only one found, because the Han River is widely known as a suicide hotspot. We'll get into why that is later, but his remains were found with another body, which was not identified publicly. The Han River flows through North Korea and South Korea, so if remains are not found promptly, they believe that likely they floated into North Korea. However, remains often wash up to shore or surface much earlier than this, but the weather had been windy. Jung-woo's family was devastated and demanded that they search for the rest of his remains to determine what had happened to him. They had to wait 2 more weeks for conclusive DNA results that would identify the remains as absolutely belonging to Jung-woo, because the clothes were also badly decomposed, and his shoes were just a popular sneaker brand. Jung-woo's cousin criticized the police for not taking their case seriously and conducting a full investigation into him being missing the weeks prior. He believed that if the police had started their investigation early, they may have found his remains within a few days, which would have helped unravel the puzzle without the loss of evidence from the water. His family insisted that he didn't have any circumstances in his life that would lead him to jump off of a bridge and commit suicide. Although suicide is not always predictable with signs, but his family was mourning. They insisted that he wasn't a gambler or put all of his money in stocks that failed, which economic failure and debt are very large factors for suicide, and to them he had no evidence of depression. So they were disappointed that his missing persons case wasn't investigated as potential human trafficking, especially now that only half of his body was discovered. They believed that the body separation may not have been due to the decay of the water, but from him being murdered. But the DNA evidence came back, and it was confirmed that this was Jung-woo's remains, but there was no evidence that his body was mutilated or injured intentionally. The bones were not severed by instruments, and it appeared to be natural decay from the exposure to the elements in the river. With 2 people having gone missing, one found a month later, one still missing, people were nervous about the Gayang area. Jung-woo had gone missing at 1:30 a.m. on August 7, 2022, and 23 and a half hours later, on August 8, Park Soo-min disappeared as well. Soo-min's family declined publicly searching for her or going on TV to talk about the case, so very little is known about her. She was a 38-year-old woman who was last seen leaving Exit 2 at Gayang Station, walking towards Gayang Bridge. She had long straight hair and wore a short-sleeve gray shirt, black exercise pants, and a brown purse. She disappeared into the darkness of the night and was never found again. Her story is short, but with these 3 disappearances, people began to speculate that something more was happening near the bridge. Some people talked about evil forces or human traffickers, but evidence of any crime or other has yet to be found. Merely that the Han River bridges are often the location of many people's final moments before they jump into the water. Korea is known to have a rather high suicide rate. It has been extensively studied as to why this is occurring. The numbers are reported as accurately as possible to help stop this problem from continuing, although it has been proven to be an issue much bigger and deeply rooted than the government has been able to tackle or has wanted to solve. With suicide rates in South Korea being so high, specifically the highest rate reported in the world, it should be a national emergency. Per 100,000 people in South Korea, 24.7 people commit suicide. That is 3.7 more than the next country, which is Hungary, and 5.3 more than Japan, a country known for its problem with suicide. For my American audience, as many of my listeners are from North America, that is more than double America's rate of 10.1 per 100,000 people. Countries all have their own problems, but with South Korea's dropping birth rate and increasing suicide rate, people are afraid for the future. What is the real cost of living in South Korea, with so much of the population suffering? Between 2020 and 2022, 39,453 people took their own lives in South Korea. This rate isn't showing any signs of slowing down. There isn't just one or two factors going into why people are making this fatal decision. Although economic hardships are known as the most common reason known for suicide in South Korea, especially amongst young men. Women, however, are at an economic disadvantage because they make less money when working, have less career opportunities, and are expected to manage household chores and childcare. This, also paired with workplace discrimination and high rates of sexual harassment, has led to women's suicide rates being higher than that of men. According to a study of suicide rates in South Korea by researchers at Kotongne University, pervasive gender discrimination, instability in women's employment, violence against women, and the burden of family life has led to the feminization of poverty and the deterioration of women's quality of life in South Korea. While women's suicide is more easily studied because women are more likely to seek help, it is known that the stigma men face from trying to receive help for depression or mental illness is a factor in suicide rates for men. Discussing all of the root causes for suicide in South Korea would be interesting, but let's rather focus on the story of another famous suicide in South Korea that has received far too little publicity. As I'm writing this case, the International Transgender Day of Visibility is occurring. As a queer woman, I think we should discuss the suicide of Byun Hee-soo, the first out transgender woman in the South Korean army. Byun Hee-soo grew up knowing that she would be a part of the Republic of Korea's military. She even attended a military high school that trained her to become an exemplary soldier. She graduated from high school and was commissioned into the military in 2017. At this time, she expressed to her friends that she was having some questions about her own gender, which then she expressed her gender in a masculine way. She identified herself as a man then, but she knew that wasn't who she wanted to be. Hee-soo visited the military hospital to speak to a psychologist and began to acknowledge and understand that her feelings about her own gender were real. Speaking about her problems to a psychologist made her realize that while she did dream of being part of the military and wanted to continue her service, she had to be true to herself, that self-expression and honesty with yourself is so important, especially when you're in such a conforming environment such as the military. You need to hold on to that connection you have to yourself. I have always believed that our connection to ourselves should be protected and cherished. Hee-soo decided to prioritize her own happiness by opting for gender-affirming care in November 2019. Initially apprehensive about revealing her decision to her unit in the 5th Armored Brigade, she waited before sharing this news. When she finally mustered the courage to open up to her unit, whom she had grown close to as their commander, they not only supported her but also cheered her on, giving her hope and courage for the future. With the backing of her battalion, Hee-soo was granted permission to travel to Thailand for gender-affirming surgery. However, amidst the support and joy, Hee-soo knew challenges would await her when she returned. She anticipated that her military qualifications would be reassessed to align with those of a female soldier who has a lot less duties than that of a male soldier. Following Sergeant Byun Hee-soo's request to continue serving in the military as a woman, the Military Human Rights Center held a press conference. At the age of 22, while serving as a non-commissioned officer and commander of the 5th Armored Brigade, Hee-soo underwent gender-affirming surgery in Thailand. She was still on active duty, but took vacation time to travel to Thailand. When she returned after the healing process from her surgery, which we will not go into the details of, she petitioned to be reinstated as an active duty officer as a woman. Her case was given to the Military Human Rights Center, and that's when they held a press conference. This was the first such case to ever be brought forward, so it was going to be a very publicized one. This could set a precedent for other transgender soldiers to openly serve in the military. Byun Hee-soo began her speech by stating that since she was a young child, she wanted to become a soldier and protect the nation. She worked hard to be accepted into military high school and passed the strict examination process. She was proud she'd achieved her lifelong dream of becoming an NCO. However, even after achieving her dreams, she wasn't fully happy. Something deep in her heart wasn't right. She felt an emptiness inside herself as symptoms of depression and gender dysphoria crept in. As time went on, she knew she wouldn't be able to serve in the military much longer if she didn't get help for her depression. Her friends didn't know what her depression stemmed from and suggested that she take a break from the military and just be reviewed for unsuitability for active duty. But her dream was to serve her country as a soldier. So she stomached her dark thoughts and soldiered on, but there was only so much more pretending that she could do before the overwhelming sadness overtook her life. That's when she made the choice to seek psychiatric care at the military hospital. The psychiatrist heard her dilemma and advised her that the best solution to her condition would be to actively understand and resolve the feelings, rather than letting them accumulate in her mind. That's when she came out to her unit and received the support she so desperately needed and wanted. As an award-winning armor crewman specializing in operating tanks, she'd been the only one in her battalion to receive an A grade in tank operation. She was so proud of her achievements and always tried to be the best of the best. With a recommendation from the military psychiatrist and doctors, she was granted an extended vacation to receive the surgery she requested for gender affirmation. She was granted this without any issues because of her exemplary record with her unit. In the press conference, Yisu thanked her commanders, unit members, and fellow soldiers who all helped her to discover what would truly make her happy and to get the gender-affirming care that saved her life. Yisu asked for the consideration of the Republic of Korea Army Headquarters to reinstate her as a female soldier. Yisu would be the first openly transgender soldier in the South Korean Army and be the only female soldier to have ever experienced the full training of the Army. Women have a much different experience in the military. She acknowledged that the military may not be ready to accept a transgender soldier yet, and that she herself was hesitant, but she believed that the military could continue to make progress to respect all humans' rights. When she joined the military in high school, she recalled that even minor problems would result in serious disciplinary action, but now there is much more humanity and compassion towards mistakes made by new soldiers. Of course, Yisu wasn't in a position to criticize the military or talk about anything negative, which potentially she didn't have any negative experiences, but the military has a very long history of not being very welcoming to LGBTQIA+ people. Yisu wanted to remain as a good example of how transgender people can serve their country and contribute strength and expertise to the military. She wanted to remain as a frontline soldier ready to be deployed. That was the end of her speech, which concluded with a Q&A portion. She was asked about how she was told she would be discharged from the military and if she wanted to come out as a transgender woman while in the military. Yisu never had any intention of coming out, but felt it was necessary if she did want to receive the gender-affirming care. At a point, it would be difficult to hide her gender expression and true self. She was hopeful that she could be reinstated, but feared for the worst. She said it felt like she was losing someone she loved or being told she was losing a limb. There was nothing she could do about being discharged, and it was hurting her deeply. When asked about the military's intention behind not allowing transgender people in the Army, she said that even a few years prior, the Navy had incidents where they searched for gay men to kick out of the military. She believed it was an ongoing fear in the military to have homosexual men, and therefore any sexual and gender minorities. By January 16, 2020, 2 months after she returned from receiving gender-affirming surgery, the Republic of Korea Army Headquarters announced their decision to refuse to allow Byun Hee-soo to return to duty. With this decision, the case became public information and started to be covered by the press. The case was covered by every media outlet. It was on all of the front pages of news websites. Accompanying these articles was a photograph of Hee-soo at the press conference in tears, pleading for her right to serve the country. Byun Hee-soo filed a complaint against the Army Chief of Staff to cancel her discharge and reconsider the petition. She also made it known that she could not be reinstated at her current position, that she would like to reenlist as a female soldier, even if that meant losing all of her rank and status. The Army Headquarters tried to state that they would uphold their decision because they had no knowledge that Hee-soo would be getting gender-affirming surgery in Thailand, which was a lie they couldn't uphold. Hee-soo had proof of her interactions with all of the informed commanders, doctors, and fellow soldiers. She had even filed a formal request to leave for medical reasons, with the medical reason being the surgeries that she received. But none of this was on official paperwork regarding the approvals. Most of this was done over personal communication or face-to-face. She knew that they were lying, but they could ultimately make the decision without any proof. Ban Hee-soo and the Military Human Rights Center continued to work together to appeal the decision to hopefully bring in an era of respecting human rights in the military. However, as the appeals continued, Hee-soo was required to get an examination at the Armed Forces Capital Hospital to determine her physical health and mental health. She'd been seeing doctors for years, so this wasn't really anything new, but they wanted to see if she was ready to return to duty. The doctors finally got back to her about the result and told Hee-soo that they had diagnosed her with what is called level 3 mental and physical disability. In the Korean military, a soldier is graded on their physical and mental well-being to determine how well they can serve. A level 1 would mean you have absolutely no disease mentally or physically. That would be you're in the best of health. A person who is between 1 and 4, with 4 being that the soldier has some problems, can continue to serve in active duty at the discretion of their commanding officer. Level 5 cannot serve in active duty, but may be drafted. Level 6 cannot serve, and level 7 cannot serve until re-examined after they heal or prove that their disability will not affect their career as a soldier. These grades are also applied to civilians in Korea who are disabled to determine the basic income and assistance that they receive. The levels are slightly different, but they're still based on their ability to perform daily activities and the impact of their disease or disability. Hee-soo's level 3 diagnosis did not fit the fact that she was in recovery of a major surgery. In a few months' time, she would have been ready to return to active duty. Her physical and mental health, according to her, were healthier than ever. It seemed that because the case had become so public and so large, the military needed to take a stance on whether or not they believed transgender people to be suffering from mental illness. At this time, as the public, we do not know what the doctors told Hee-soo. Perhaps her gender dysphoria, which many transgender people experience, was a large factor in the level of her mental health grade. The appeal and denial process went on for an entire year across 2020. By February 1st, 2021, the National Human Rights Commission was involved and on her behalf tried to get the forcible discharge from the military canceled. The Army quickly responded with a swift no. They said their decision was unanimous. Ban Hee-soo now had very little chance of returning to the military in any manner. But she was being praised by the entire queer LGBTQIA+ community as a beacon of hope. Regardless, if anyone wanted to actually join the military or serve as a transgender person, it was a precedent that would open the discussion for other human rights discussions. To Ban Hee-soo, it felt as if there was little to no hope for her anymore. Her childhood dreams were being crushed merely because the military refused to accept who she was. She'd faced so many obstacles and the immovable decision by the military. Despite this, Hee-soo was a symbol of courage, of resilience to the LGBTQIA+ community. But she didn't set off with this as her goal. Nobody knew the burden that this was placing on her heart. To this day, in 2024, in South Korea, being a sexual minority or being a transgender person is considered a disability and a mental illness. There are no laws banning discrimination against LGBTQIA+ people, but it is slowly changing due to the hard work of queer and transgender people in Korea who have always existed and always will exist. I had the pleasure of attending multiple queer festivals and parades in South Korea. The acceptance and love is there, but it's surrounded by so much anger and hate. It will take a long time to change. Amnesty International spoke out about Ban Hee-soo's situation and stated that the ban on military service for sexual and non-cisgender people institutionalizes discrimination. It can cause or justify violence against people in society even beyond the military. The director of the Military Human Rights Center, Im Tae-hoon, came forward applauding Hee-soo by stating, "There are transgender soldiers serving with bated breath. We will fight with Sergeant Byun, who courageously revealed that transgender people do exist in our military." It's extremely unlikely that Ban Hee-soo was the only person in the military that was transgender, just as there's a likelihood that many people that are queer have served in the military, considering that military service is mandatory for men or people assigned male at birth. Ban Hee-soo received word of the final decision on February 28, 2021. The decision was so overwhelming for her. Someone who had patriotism running in her veins was let down in such a disappointing way by her own government. She just wanted to be alone. Ban Hee-soo cut off contact with her family and friends for the remainder of the day. Then she wouldn't leave her home for the entire rest of the week. 3 days later, on March 3, 2021, Sergeant Byun-hee Soo was found dead in her home at 5:49 p.m. After not being able to be contacted for days, a wellness check was called in. The police and fire authorities were not able to get in contact with Hee Soo, who was confirmed to be in her apartment, so they pried open the metal door to attempt a rescue, but found that Hee Soo had taken her life prior to their arrival. Hee Soo had reported extreme stress in the days prior to her psychiatrist. Following Byun-hee Soo's death, the many different human rights associations and groups came forward to mourn her passing. A representative of Sukmyung Women's University posted a memorial on social media that said, "Compared to a three-leaf clover, a four-leaf clover is a mutation, but sometimes we look for a four-leaf clover to bring good luck. Sergeant Byun-hee Soo will forever be remembered as the smiling tank operator." On December 1, 2022, Hee Soo's family sought to have her buried in the military cemetery since they argued she died in the line of duty as a patriotic soldier. However, the decision was made to classify her death as a regular death and not a death in the line of duty. Soldiers who die of natural causes while in mandatory military service are even considered having died in the line of duty. But one of the most passionate, patriotic soldiers they had couldn't be considered? This decision was supported by the fact that they had already decided to discharge her from the military by the time she died. After some more deliberation, the review committee did decide to recognize that Hee Soo's discharge would not deny her status of being a former sergeant. Brigadier General Park, Hee Soo's commanding officer, spoke on her behalf in multiple meetings before and after her death, which led to his demotion, although the military denies that this was the reasoning behind the demotion. With such a high rate of suicide in South Korea, and the story of Gaeul, Jung-woo, Soo-min, and Hee Soo, the government's constant fear was that this would lead to more deaths. Beureuteureu hyogwa, or the Werther effect, is a phenomenon in psychology and criminology in which following a suicide of an idolized or prominent person, many more people will commit suicide in the time following. The term Werther effect comes from the Johann Wolfgang von Goethe novel, The Sorrows of Young Werther, in which the main character dies. Following the release of the novel, many young readers in turn took their own lives as well. This phenomenon has been observed following the death of Elvis, Michael Jackson, Japanese star Hide. In Korea specifically, between 2017 and 2020, three prominent celebrities committed suicide. Jonghyun from the K-pop group SHINee, Suri from the K-pop group FX, and Guhara from K-pop group Kara. In the weeks following their deaths, the number of deaths from suicide increased significantly. Though to fully understand the situation, the death of the public figure isn't the cause of the suicides that occur following it. It's that the people who had a predisposition to commit suicide experience the trigger that their plans for suicide can be carried out. The opportunity solidifies itself in their minds when they see that someone else has done what they're considering. Take, for instance, one of the most publicized suicides in American history, the death of Kurt Cobain. This isn't the place to argue about whether or not it was a suicide, but the case was covered as a suicide, so we will consider it as such. Kurt Cobain's death was covered everywhere for a very long time, with suicide hotline numbers on screen. These suicide hotlines saw a drastic increase of callers expressing that Cobain's death increased their own suicidal ideation. Clinical psychologists generally agree that the standard for reporting on suicide in the news and through media sources are excessive and only serve to cause more harm to others who may also be struggling with suicide. The purpose of these stories often is to express shock, garner views, and make money. Although not all Werther effect examples are due to publicized deaths of famous people, in some instances, it can be tied to a specific location. In South Korea, the Han River is known for its ties to many suicides. In particular, on this river is the famous Mapo Bridge, which is a large highway that crosses the Han River. This six-lane bridge has the morbid history of being a hotspot of suicide. People come from all over Korea to jump off this bridge to end their lives. The situation is so bad that police monitor the bridge on known high suicide days, like the day of the college entrance exams. The bridge now has CCTV covering its entirety, and loitering on this bridge will summon the police. In efforts to dissuade suicidal people from taking their own lives, Samsung Life Insurance installed sensors on the railings and covered the bridge in positive messages in 2012. The bridge was renamed the Bridge of Life as a way to help prevent suicide. Some of these messages read, "The wind is nice, isn't it? The most shining moment of your life hasn't happened yet." Or, "Your worries will feel like nothing when you get older." But some of these messages were even more questionable. Some of them read, "Aren't you tired? What are you thinking about?" And, "You must have a hard time." These messages were meant to sound sympathetic or empathetic, but ended up just making the situation a lot worse. The rebranding of the bridge was done without the consultation of psychologists. These messages were just written by people working on the graphic design of the railings, not anyone with any expertise in suicide prevention. For example, according to psychologists who have spoken out about the bridge, asking suicidal people if they've been eating well, how their day was, or what they're thinking about when they're suffering only further makes them focus on the situation they're currently in. Talking about how nice the wind is or how blue the sky is can make them think about how they want to escape the world. These phrases may feel harmless, but to someone who is in a suicidal headspace, these may trigger further negative feelings. Some of the worst phrases on the bridge included one that said, "It isn't like you have cancer or anything, so just get older." There were also Korean puns on the bridge that sought to make someone laugh at how bad they were. Then there was another that was just the question, "Are you good at swimming?" This one was notorious for feeling like it was actively provoking suicidal people to jump. According to Thomas Joyner, who wrote Why People Die by Suicide and developed the interpersonal theory of suicide, there are three psychological conditions felt by those who have suicidal ideation. First, they feel socially isolated. Second, they feel burdened by their perception of being a burden to others. And third, they feel fearlessness or indifference to pain. If any one of these conditions is missing, it's highly unlikely a person will give in to their suicidal thoughts. Therefore, the way to prevent people from committing suicide on the bridge is really only one method: physically taking away the opportunity, or making them less fearless of pain, which would be drowning. This may sound cruel to want suicidal people to be afraid of dying, but it is effective in then preventing suicide in the moment. Of course, this isn't the end goal, just merely preventing suicide on the bridge. There must be a way to help people with their psychological needs and improve their quality of life to long-term prevent suicide. Following the failure of these controversial phrases that resulted in an increase in suicides at the Mapo Bridge, a high fence and catching net was installed on the bridge, which has now almost stopped suicide from occurring on what is now coined the Bridge of Death in 2019. If you or someone you know is going through a mental health crisis, please do not hesitate to seek help. There are resources and compassionate people willing to support you. Asking for assistance is not a sign of weakness. Always remember that you are not defined by the challenges you are facing. I will end today's episode with a poem, Beloved by Gal, who recorded it on her blog. To the Daffodil by Chung Ho Sung. Don't cry. Because you're lonely, you're human. To live is to endure loneliness. Don't wait for the call that's not coming. When it snows, walk on the snowy path. When it rains, walk on the rainy path. At the reed forest, the black-breasted longbill is watching you. At times, even God sheds tears, feeling lonely. Because of loneliness, the birds are sitting on the boughs. Because of loneliness, you are sitting by the stream. Once a day, even the mountain shadow comes down to the village, feeling lonely. Even the bell rings outward, out of loneliness. As always, thank you for listening to Korean True Crime. I hope you enjoyed today's episode topic. If you'd like to vote on future episode topics or hear bonus content, join Korean True Crime's Patreon today. Stickers and hoodies are now available. If you'd like to hear more, follow the show wherever you listen and be sure to leave a review. 다음에 또 봐요. See you next time.